I'm Jennifer Ackerman-Haywood, and you're listening to the Craft Sanity Podcast, an interview show all about art, craft, and creativity. This episode of Craft Sanity is sponsored by Libby Dibby. You can find skirts, hand-stamped charms, baby slings, bags, and more over at libertyworth.com. Also check out the Etsy shop, libertyworth.etsy.com, and check out the Libby Dibby blog at libbydibbystuff.blogspot.com. So let's get to it, folks. It's time to craft sanity. Well, hello, folks. Welcome to episode 112 of the Craft Sanity Podcast. My guest this week is Rebecca Yeager. And let me just tell you that this interview has been years in the making. I met Rebecca years ago at the Detroit Urban Craft Fair, and we had this long conversation, and I was intrigued from the beginning. And I really can't explain why it's taken so long for us to connect and actually record a podcast, but I'm so happy that we finally did it, because Rebecca is really inspiring and really entertaining the way she tells stories. And for those of you who are not familiar with her work, she is a Minneapolis-based designer, and she has a website called hazelandmelvin.com. She makes custom crib bedding, diaper bags, nursing pillows, quilts, all that stuff that you register for at big box stores. And you have usually kind of limited choices and some of the fabric patterns. I know I ended up just skipping the bedding package, you know, where you can register for a whole bedding set. I just completely skipped it because I looked at all these different patterns and nothing really spoke to me. So I ended up just making some of my own bedding for the crib and called it good. I didn't whip up anything as styling as the stuff that Rebecca does. And Rebecca does this for her clients. And people actually, there's a gift registry, so you can actually register for a really sweet custom designed bedding set. And, you know, she started this business back in 2005 after coming from the corporate world. And I think you're going to really enjoy hearing her story, because she did not take that straight path going to design school and then launching her own handmade business. Rebecca also, we're going to talk about her book. She is the co-author of One Yard Wonders. It's a relatively new book that's out that has 101 projects that you can sew from one yard of fabric or less. So there's a lot of inspiration in that book. So if you have stacks of fabric like I do that are just sitting there, chances are you page through, there's going to be at least a project or two that's going to appeal to you, you know, from this book, and hopefully it will inspire you to start cutting. So we're going to give you a chance to win a copy of that book also. So stick around after the show for those details. In the meantime, grab a project, settle in, pour yourself some tea or your favorite beverage, and prepare to be entertained by Rebecca Yeager. Well, Rebecca, thank you so much for being a guest on Craft Sanity. I'm so excited to get to interview you, because I know we met the Detroit Urban Craft Fair back in 2007, mm-hmm. and then again at Renegade in Chicago. So our paths have crossed a couple times. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what you're doing now, and then we'll back up and kind of start at the roots of your creativity here.
What I'm doing now is pretty loaded, I think. This past late October, early November, my friend Patricia Hoskins and I came out with a new book called One Yard Wonders. And so far it's been met with rave reviews. We're very happy. With that said, we're already working with the publisher on round number two. So we're in the preliminary phases of that. And I'm just sort of like waiting for that to take hold to really dive into that project. Coming off of the holidays is always a little time to relax, thankfully.
Can you tell us a little bit about your business as well?
Yeah. So I have a business called Hazel and Melvin's Room, which I started in December of 2005. So prior to that, I was working for Target Corporation here in Minneapolis. I was a senior designer. I was in charge of women's Cherokee clothing, all of plus sizes, and maternity. And that was a lot of work. And somebody once said to me that working at Target is like getting another degree, which is true. Wow. It was like being in school all over again. So many hours and a lot of work and a lot of great people and a lot of fun, but it was time to do something else. So I left Target in December 2005. and started a business, which I had been considering earlier that year, called Hazel and Melvin's Room, and the premise of which was to bring people interesting, exciting baby bedding and other baby products that were not pastel. I mean, and now to say that is a little silly because there's so many people out there doing it, and I'm, you know, it's not so revolutionary, but it's still very exciting. At the time when I set out to start that business, what I thought I would do is create some different bedding sets like bumpers, fitted sheets, cribs, mm-hmm. and then sell them online. Well, quickly, I would say within 6 months of that time, I realized that the business was not going to be in just having stuff available for sale, but really customizing things. So quickly, the business turned into custom baby bedding. And I still do have some things for sale on my website where they're just sort of ready-made, ready to go, ship out the door. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, I work with people one-on-one and design exactly what they want to fit into their baby space. So whether they look through my fabric galleries, which I have online some, and find something they like, or whether they say to me, you know, we really want to go with this color scheme and we would like, I don't know, some, I don't want to say owls because everybody wants owls, but we want unicorns. And I will work with them to try to, you know, to fill in what their needs are. And that's worked out really well. And it's also nice for me because I'm not sitting on a lot of inventory waiting to sell it. And I really enjoy working with people.
Well, that sounds really fun.
It's been really amazing. I'm very fortunate that my brother has been a great partner in this and that he put together my website for me. And he is, I think web savvy would be an understatement. I don't fully understand what he does, but it's pretty fantastic. And I have very high placement in search engines without having to pay for that stuff. I don't know how it happened, but it happened, and I give him all the credit.
Well, that's great. Well, and also you've put your time in. I mean, you've been doing this for a while, so I'm sure your name's out there and people are going back to you when they have a second child or have a friend that is expecting. Yeah. So
it's true. It happens. And there's always a spike whenever I have, and I haven't had any lately, but there'll be these times where I get some press and suddenly it's wild. And I'm just like, oh my God, how can I do this? How can I fulfill these orders? but like so many crafters, I do. I manage.
You just caffeinate and go, you know.
Yeah.
What would we do without caffeine? I don't know.
You know, I'm not a big drinker of caffeine.
No, you're a lucky one then.
Yeah, I drink coffee because I like the milk. And
I've never heard anybody say that's why they drink coffee before. So that's,
yeah, I really like a latte because I like that fluffy frothy milk.
Yeah.
And I'm a big fan of the caffeine-free Diet Coke.
Well, that's good for you. Good for you. I'm the one twitching if I haven't had caffeine. So so what kind of trends are you seeing with the bedding for nurseries now?
Well, I've had a lot of requests for yellow, which is hard to fulfill because there's not – I have a hard time finding interesting prints in yellows. But, I mean, just this morning I was going through the new CB2 catalog or even like the new West Elm catalog, and it's all really hot yellow. And it looks – it looks really nice. It's really pretty. But I think in general, it's things that are more unconventional, things that are more geometric. I wish I had more like sort of mod, abstract, geometric prints to work with because I think that there's a huge opportunity there.
Have you ever thought about designing your own prints to use?
I have, and I would love to do my own prints, but I haven't really explored that. And it's funny. I mean, I have experience doing print and pattern design before I was at Target. I was at Kmart in Michigan, and sounds crazy to say that I design clothing for Kmart, but somebody's got to do it, right?
Hey, when I was a kid, I wore a lot of clothing from Kmart, so, you know, I'm not going to knock that, you know?
Well, we're both from Michigan, and yeah. So is Kmart, so there you go.
Yeah.
But I used to do a lot of print and pattern design for Kmart and then some for Target, so I'm pretty skilled with, you know, breaking down the colors and putting things into repeat and the different types of repeats. But it's not something that I've managed to really fit in to my schedule. And I'm also really, I don't know if I'm embarrassed or sad or both, to say that I haven't taken the opportunity to use spoon flour yet.
I haven't either, but it's so intriguing.
And I'm so kicking myself that I didn't create spoon flour.
It's total genius. Yeah, it's complete total genius.
I mean, there are these people with these huge machines, these fabric printing machines, and they're struggling because they're like trying to get the most banner business they can get to make, to create banners and things. And there are these, you know, these brilliant people who are like, guess what? We will do fabric yardage, custom fat quarters, whatever you want. And it's so reasonable. I mean, the prices are great, and I just really haven't taken the time to sit down and do it, but it's on my list.
Well, I'd like to kind of back up. Maybe we can go back to your days in Michigan. Were you born here in Michigan?
I was, yes.
Yeah, where did you grow up?
I was born in a hospital in Detroit.
So was I.
I have no idea which one.
You have no idea which one? Yeah.
Originally, we lived in Southfield.
Okay, yep.
And then we moved to Bloomfield Hills. And my parents still live there. And my brother still lives in Michigan, too. But the funny thing was, is like, I ended up going to a high school that I could have walked to from the first house we lived in, but it was like 15 miles from the house I really grew up in, which was so strange.
Yeah. When you were a kid, I mean, were you making things? Were you sewing as a kid?
I do remember always sewing. And I remember breaking my mom's sewing machine and not hearing the end of it. And I actually put that in my bio of the One Yard Wonders book. And she calls me or she sends me an email. She says, you never broke my sewing machine. I don't know what you're talking about. But it's funny. You know, it's quite possible that I didn't, because I tend to like to, I don't realize I do it. And it's not like the John Lovitz pathological liar from Saturday Night Live, but I tend to like sort of embellish with time. And I think that's what makes stories exciting. So far, I've told you the 100% of the truth. Okay. I've not embellished anything. Okay. But I did make a lot of things. My mom sewed quite a bit. Like, I remember she made my brother and I these most fantastic sleeping bags. His was a shark and mine was a walrus. And the whole top of the sleeping bag was like appliqued, so it looks like you're laying inside a walrus.
Oh, wow.
And she used to make Barbie clothes, which I tried to make Barbie clothes once. And oh my God, I don't understand those like quarter inch seams, not even, I think eighth inch seams.
Yeah,
it was like
really
tedious,
hard.
Terrible work. But she made a lot of Barbie clothes. And it's funny to think that she actually did a lot of sewing. She made, I remember, these ski jackets and ski suits. She made matching ski suits for she and my dad. And now it's like, we hem these pants, or she uses stitch witchery to hem things. And I'm just like, what happened? But so I was sewing quite a bit. And I remember in college, I had a very good friend, and she and I used to have these massive sewing sessions, and we'd make these fantastic Halloween costumes. And I did a lot of sewing then. And then, maybe counterintuitive to what I'm doing now, my degree in college is in Russian language and literature, which maybe you think it should be in design or something, but it's not.
So where did you go to college?
I went to college at the University of Michigan.
Were you considering art and design at all? Or
no. I wanted to be an engineer.
And then how did you end up? Okay. So how did you land on the major that you did? Okay, you wanted to be an engineer. You had this natural instinct of artistic design instinct, but you ended up where you did. How did that happen?
I think I wanted to be an engineer because my dad is an engineer, and okay. He was such a workaholic, but I would go to the office with him every Saturday and hang out, you know, and it was just like this thing that I did every Saturday without fail. And I just wanted to, and he owned his own business. And I think in high school or middle school, it's like, I'm going to take over I'm going to run my dad's business when it's time. And I went to college and I took, well, calculus. I always loved math until calculus, and calculus killed me. And since then I need a calculator. And I took chemistry, and it was just like, oh my gosh, being in this class with 450 people, was too much and I just couldn't deal. But in high school, my last year of high school, I took Russian language. And I did, this was in 1990, and we did a one-month exchange program. And I went to Kiev and lived with a family for a month. And that was really, that had quite an impact on me. And it was really exciting. And I made a commitment that I wanted to, I didn't really know Russian. They knew English fairly well, but I made a commitment that I wanted to learn Russian so that I could go back and speak to them in Russian. Mm-hmm. And so I kept taking Russian in college, and I did go back and visit them, and I didn't really speak to them in Russian. But but in my junior year of college, I'm like, okay, I got to pick this major. And I sat down. I'm like, okay, what do I have the most credits in? What have I got the best grades in? What do I enjoy? What do I enjoy the most? And that was pretty much it. I did take some art classes in college, but I never pursued, or I never even considered getting an art degree, which I'm fine with. And so I ended up majoring in Russian language and literature. And when I graduated college, I'm like, okay, now what? And I did an internship program through Boston University, and I moved to Moscow for what was supposed to be 6 months. And I had an internship with Cosmopolitan magazine there, and had a great time, made a lot of friends, and decided to stay. And I was there for just under 3 years.
Wow. That must have been a really great experience. I mean, to live.
It was crazy town. It was absolutely crazy and absolutely fun. And I moved back to the States in late 96. I mean, it seems so long ago. There were the years when people were like, oh, what was it like living in Russia? I mean, now it's 14 years ago. Who cares? Nobody asks, and I don't really remember. And I haven't been back, and I want to go back. And I just got back in touch with a friend of mine who is still there. I can't believe it.
Oh, wow. An American friend that stayed?
Yes. She's,
yeah.
Wow. From Nebraska, and she's got two kids. She had two, and she's in her, I don't know if they're married, but her boyfriend, husband, father of the children is British, and they met there. And I don't know, it's just an incredible experience, and I would really like to go back.
So when you were at the magazine, were you writing, or what were you doing at the magazine?
I was assisting at photo shoots. Oh, okay. And I was ironing, and I was like going to boutiques and picking up clothes and dropping off clothes. And then I was also, I remember compiling a database at the time. Now they write things that are specific to the Russian people, but they were just starting out the magazine. So it was owned by a Dutch company, and it probably still, it may still be, I don't know, but we would go through old other issues of Cosmo in English language and find articles that would be applicable to Russian culture that would then be translated.
Okay.
It was very glamorous.
Well, it sounds like it.
Yes.
Very high-end fashion kind of thing. Yeah, that sounds great. And so when you came back to the States, what did you decide to do?
I wasn't sure what I was going to do when I moved back. I considered for at least 5 minutes getting a master's in fashion design, because I thought my interest was really in clothing design. So I took some classes at Wayne State in Detroit, which you might be familiar with.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Of course. Yep.
And decided, you know, I don't really want or need a master's degree in fashion design. And through them, I had learned about, so I just took classes like, what do you say, post-bachelor.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I learned about an internship at Winkelmann's, which is now out of business. But Winkelmann's used to be this really fabulous.
Oh, yeah. It was very fancy.
It was a very fancy department store, and it quickly, well, not quickly, but through the years became very not fancy and very, right, very kind of trashy.
Isn't that amazing? I've seen a couple stores like that in the Detroit area where it goes from super fancy, like you go there with your Christmas dress after your parent for a Christmas dress if your parents, yeah, have saved up tons of cash, and then it goes to a discount. You know, I know Crowley's that happened too, where it was,
oh, right,
fancy, and then I worked there.
Trashy.
Then it went totally like Value City type of, and I'm like, yeah, whoa, how did this happen? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Winkelmann's was kind of like that, but it was a great opportunity, and I worked in their product design department. And it was while I was there that they were in bankruptcy.
Oh yeah,
and things were not going well. And this was a paid internship. I made $6 an hour, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah, because a lot of internships don't pay, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought it was kind of a joke because by the time, I mean, I was there for a good 6 months, and by the end of my 6 month period, I was the only person in that department, and I was running the product design department for $6 an hour.
Oh, that is ridiculous.
As an intern. And I remember them offering me a job because I think that they were still thinking they could pull out of their bankruptcy, and they offered me a job for something like, I don't know, in the 20s.
Oh boy.
$1,000, you know, like 23 or something thousand dollars. I was like, what?
To run a whole department.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks, but no thanks. So at that time I was still taking classes at Wayne State, and I learned they were looking to hire at Kmart. So I beefed up my resume and I wrote on my resume that I'm doing post-bachelor work in fashion design and merchandising, which is what it was. It was after my bachelor's degree.
Right.
And that I, was working at Winkleman's, and I said I was, oh God, I gave myself a title. I didn't say I was an intern, and I didn't disclose how much money I'm making because you don't have to.
Right.
Anyway, I get this totally sweet job at Kmart, which was entry level as a designer, because, and after the fact, somebody said to me, so when did you graduate from Wayne State again? I said, post-bachelor work doesn't mean that I graduated. They thought I had a graduate degree. They completely misread my resume.
Oh.
And by then I'm like, haha, joke's on you. I've got a job.
Right. Oh goodness.
And that was my first real job, like salaried job.
Right.
And I excelled. I was there for 5 years. And by the end I was a senior designer, and I was recruited by Target to move to Minneapolis.
Oh, that's exciting.
So I'm sort of, there comes this time, you know, people, you know, I think a degree is definitely relevant, but my job experience became my degree. So it didn't matter that I had a degree or not, but it was really funny because working at Target, you go to these design meetings and people go around the room and say where their background was. And you have people saying, oh, I'm from Ralph Lauren, or I'm from, you know, The Gap, or I'm from, I don't know, Calvin Klein, or, you know, whatever. They were all from New York, and I'd be like, yeah, Kmart, Michigan, no fashion degree. Didn't go to FIT, didn't go to Parsons, whatever. Sorry, dude.
You know what, though? I think that really kind of rocks because, you know, when you have, because you didn't take the same path, but you got to the same place. And,
right.
You know, I think that's awesome. So that must have been kind of fun to,
put that
on the table, you know.
It was embarrassing kind of too. I mean, I feel really bad that I was embarrassed by it because it's actually really funny and really fun. But at the time it was just kind of intimidating. I think you have to be in the environment to understand the intimidation, but I don't, you know, I didn't want to be, you know, have less validity or have less credentials.
Right. I felt a little bit like that. I had an internship at Newsday on Long Island when I was in college, and I went to Central Michigan University, which is, you know, it's what I could afford,
right,
paying my own way through school. And I went out there with my CMU sticker on the back of my cutlass. Okay. And so I drive out there and people are like, oh, Carnegie Mellon. I'm like, no, it's Central Michigan. They're like, well, where exactly is that? I'm like, well, it would be in Central Michigan. But it was like, you know, there were kids from Northwestern and, you know, Columbia and like some really very impressive schools. And I was from a school that, you know, wasn't hard to get into. And it was just, you know, kind of an, you know, just average school with, you know, and it was just really hilarious because I was like from the off-brand school out doing this internship with kids that were coming from really impressive schools. And, you know, so I just be like, so I can kind of,
you're more of an impressive person then.
Well, it's funny because I can relate to that because now I think it was really awesome that I was from Central Michigan and out there. And at the time, you know, it was more of, you know, I can, you know, if you're saying Michigan and Kmart and I'm out there saying Michigan and everyone's from like New York schools and big schools, you know, I kind of get that. But now it's just, it makes the story funnier, you know, to know that I wasn't paying the tuition they had to pay at Columbia to get my internship, you know, and you didn't have to pay to go to FIT or Parsons, you know.
Well, now it's really funny too, because I meet people who are still at Target and they're just like, worked to the bone, and they're like, oh, there is life after Target. Now, oh, so much life after Target, you people. Come on.
Yeah. Well, and like, how you said you got to a point where you'd been thinking about it for a while before you left, but
yeah,
what really pushed you over the edge and to say, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going out on my own to be independent.
Well, I mean, I think really what started me thinking about the project or the concept of the business was friends having babies and going to these baby showers and looking at their gift registry, or doing a gift registry with a friend for her baby, going, oh my God, this is dreadful. Really? This is what you have to choose from? This is what I need to buy you as a gift? You've got to be kidding me. There's got to be something more, something better out there. I mean, and there was. I think that the only one at the time maybe doing it was Dwell Baby, but I think their prices have really come down from where they were, or maybe the cost of living has gone up, so it makes it seem a little more affordable. But I was like, oh, I can do this, and I could do so much better, and I could do so much more. And I think I was just really struggling with getting up and going, this is my life. Like, really, is this why I'm here for the good of a corporation? I mean, I shop at plenty of corporations, and I shop at Target, and that's great. But really, like, this is my life that I'm going to get up every morning and go rah rah rah, you know, go Kmart, rah rah rah, go Target. And I couldn't keep doing it.
Yeah, and so when you made the switch, did you try to like make some like come up with a betting line before you left, or no, you just kind of left and started?
No, I think what I did is, the craft event in Minneapolis, which is No Coast, December 2005 was their first year, and that was the first weekend. So I really spent a couple months prior to that making a bunch of stuff to sell at No Coast, to say, okay, locally, what's the reaction? And I didn't know what the attendance was going to be like, but I had really, really positive reaction, and I had really great support from friends who were very excited about the products. And I sort of mapped it out with my brother, who I mentioned in advance, saying, this is what I want to do. Can you help me build this? Can you help me build this website? Can you build this website?
Right.
And I just felt confident. I had a cash reserve, which is a really important thing. So I didn't really struggle with it, which is fortunate. And I just decided to make the leap, and I leapt, and here I am.
So what kind of reaction did you get when you told your colleagues that you're going to be leaving and doing your own custom bedding business?
I think they might have thought I'm crazy. I think that 2005 was still pretty fairly early on in the DIY movement. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you think it was?
I think it was. I know I started the podcast in 2006, January 2006, so... And there was quite a bit going on in 2006, but I think it was still kind of emerging from kind of this, you know, quiet, you know,
yeah,
movement that was happening, you know, in 2005. And yeah, so it wouldn't be as socially acceptable. Now you can say, okay, I'm going to have this independent business. And people have heard of Etsy, and they've heard of people selling handmade things online. In 2005, that really wasn't the climate, you know, so.
No. And, my first experience, I think, doing something like this, a friend of mine from, she still lives in Michigan, and I knew her from Kmart. She went to the Center for Creative Studies, now the College for Creative Studies in Detroit, and she was a fiber arts major. And every year, I think it's the first weekend in Detroit, they do something in conjunction with the Detroit Institute of Arts called Noel Night. And they have a student art sale where you can, if you're an alum or a student at CCS, the Center for Creative Studies, you can get a table for $50. So Michelle and I did that, I want to say in 2003, we're like, well, we can make stuff and sell it. And we made we laminated Family Circle magazines from the 50s and made like those laminated magazine bags and those marble magnets and things like that. I mean, but this was like 2002, 2003, and we made so much money, and everybody else was like selling, you know, very serious pottery and hand woven goods. And there was a huge, crazy market. People were like, whoa, what's this? What are these magnets? Or like, oh, you know what else we made? We made those record bowls.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's great. So you guys clean up, and meanwhile, the potter next to you is crying because they sold two pieces.
I know. It was crazy. But that was really my first, I guess that was my first experience with making and selling stuff that was so early on and so successful. But I just felt, I felt really good about leaving Target and doing something different and something new. And I mean, I guess everything I've done in a way has been a little unconventional. I mean, my degree choice might have been unconventional. Moving to Russia was potentially scary and exciting, and it was both of those things. And, you know, the fact that I end up working in fashion design without a degree is, I'd say now it's more unusual than it was then, but I don't know. It was a good time to do it. I don't think I could do it now. I think that there's too much competition.
Yeah. And also the economy has everyone really kind of nervous. So I think people might be hesitating longer in their day jobs just because everything's so crazy right now. But yeah, well, it sounds like things really you kind of hit the ground running, and you know, you've been able to do so much since then. So it clearly was the right move for you. Now tell me about the show, because you and Patricia also do the show together, the No Coast Craftorama.
It started in, the first one was December 2005. I had no involvement in it at that time. Actually, last year was the first one I became involved in from an organizational standpoint. I have participated in the show every year, and the first year it was like in a country club space, which they quickly outgrew. I mean, it was filled beyond capacity, beyond fire code. It was out of control. And they moved the event to a place called the Midtown Global Market, which is like an old huge Sears building that's now been converted. Last year and this year, I would say that our attendance was around 10,000 people.
Wow.
We stopped counting. we have over... around, not over, last year we had over, this year it was around 100 juried vendors. They come from all over. We try to keep a lot of people local, but we have people coming in from, you know, New York, California, Texas, and it's an incredible event. And I think what in part makes it incredible is that the Twin Cities, Minneapolis and St. Paul, really support and appreciate the arts, and people really support local artists. I mean, there's a huge arts community here in terms of, you know, handcrafted arts, theater arts, music arts, it's just a very art-centric place. And this event is totally added value.
That's awesome. And so is it a one-day event or a whole weekend?
It's 2 days. It used to be a one day. It used to just be Saturday. And then a few years ago, they did a thing where they invited you could submit a list of local boutiques and press that was a sort of like an invitation only on a Friday, so that they could come and shop and network with the vendors. And I mean, anybody could come. It wasn't invitation only. If you knew about it, you could come, but very few people knew about it except those who were invited. And that was so successful, and we scrapped that, and now it's Friday and Saturday, and it's Friday from 3 PM until 8 PM. And Saturday from 9 until 5.
Okay.
And I wonder sometimes if it should be Sunday too. And it seems weird that it's Friday and Saturday, but seriously, people take off work on Friday to go to this because they want to be there first to buy what they can buy before Saturday in case, you know, the quote unquote good stuff is gone. With the success that I had had at that sale as a vendor selling stuff, I decided in 2008 that I was going to participate in as many craft shows as I could.
Yeah.
Or maybe 2007/2008. And that's when we had met at the Detroit Urban Craft Fair.
Right, right.
And I did Renegade Chicago. I did Renegade San Francisco. And I've done Renegade Chicago again since then. And there's another event here in Minneapolis called the Craft Extravaganza. I've done that a couple times. And the thing is that now, today, if you ask me, I will do one and only one sale, and it is the No Coast Craft Fair in Minneapolis, because far and wide, you can make the most money.
Because that's the thing, when you're traveling, that's a big expense, too, to get all your stuff to where you need to go for the sale. But yeah, that sounds like a huge sale. So are tables, how much does it cost to get a booth at your show?
Sit down. I'm sure you're seated.
I am seated, yes.
I think it's $75 for 2 days.
What? Seriously, that's it? That's yeah. Awesome. That's actually, but it's hilarious because I saw my little wooden weaving looms at the artist market here in Grand Rapids. In the summer months, it's every Sunday. And I'll go down there with my stuff. You pay your $10, you know, and you get your table for the afternoon. And it's really funny because now I think every show is really expensive because I'm used to paying $10 or my Etsy commission, you know. But $75 for 2 days at a show where 10,000 people come, I think that's extremely reasonable.
$75 for a 2 day sale that if you're making, you know, the right stuff, whatever the right stuff is deemed to be.
Right.
You can make thousands of dollars.
Now, do you guys have like a huge waiting list of people trying to get into your show, trying to get booths?
I would say that the applicant pool was somewhere over 300.
Oh, wow.
And what we do when we look at it, I mean, we don't, it's sort of like, it's not like, well, if you were in last year, you're in this year. We look at everything new and fresh and we try to break things down categorically so that you don't have too many handbags or too many posters or too many baby things. Although myself included, I think we might've been a little heavy this year on the baby.
What advice do you have for people? Cause as you said, you know, you can be at the most successful show ever with tons of people coming, but if you're not really prepared or you're making something that's just not going to do well, what is a great way? What do you recommend for people that kind of test their products before they apply to be in a big show like yours?
One recommendation when you're going to apply to be in a show is photos. Don't take, you know, if the application, especially if the fee is only $75, find somebody to take good stylish photos because it's really all about the photographs you're going to take. You know, you can do a little write up about what you're selling and what your price range is, or you can write a little bio about yourself. But personally, I base everything on the photos.
Well, that's really, I mean, all you have to go on since you can't see the actual product, you have to look at the photos. And if they look crappy in terrible light on the kitchen table with a point and shoot camera,
stylize a bit and any show that's like $100 or under $100, just try it out. Because in the end of the day, I don't know that $100 is really a big expense. I'm done doing shows that are $300 because that's a total crapshoot.
Right. Cause you don't know, you have to sell quite a bit of merchandise to like just break even.
The other thing that I think is kind of good to do is with regards to pricing. One big advice to all crafters everywhere. Don't price your stuff so crazy cheap because it cheapens everybody else. I mean, I go on Etsy and you see people who are selling things for like $12 or $15 and it's just like, well, you're not paying yourself for your materials or your time. And you're certainly not paying yourself, you know, it's not a living wage.
Right.
But it also then I think makes it hard for some other crafters who are pricing themselves correctly because somebody's going to be like, well, why should I pay X when I can pay Y? Mm-hmm. But at some craft sales, what I'll do is I have like laminated price cards that I put out. Wait, I don't know if I really should say this, but what I'll do is I'll put a price out and maybe I put a higher price out. And if things don't move, I'll put a lower price.
But it's better to start with the higher price.
Cause yeah,
if you're selling stuff for, you know, $5 and the booth down the way is selling it for $25 and you sell out, but then you have no money really to show for it because you haven't paid yourself for your time. A lot of people don't even barely get their materials fee out and they say, well, you know, I just love making it. And I'm just like, wow. I don't know if it's a female thing where women tend to be more reluctant and less assertive because men don't tend to price themselves like they want to be paid for the, and they're not ashamed to ask for it. And I think sometimes women, I don't know if sometimes we have difficulty just asserting ourselves and saying, okay, this is $50. It's not 45, it's $50, you know, it's pay up.
I love it when somebody picks up something that I make and they say, how much is this? And I say $50 and they're just like, Oh, you know, and they put it down. And I'm like, that's okay. Cause somebody else is going to come along and buy it.
Right.
You know, I don't, this isn't a garage sale and I'm not negotiating.
Right.
I'm not here to negotiate. This is like you wouldn't walk into a retail space and try to negotiate. I mean, you might on an appliance, but keep in mind you're supporting an artist, right?
Right.
One thing I did do at No Coast this year that I've never done, and I think this is just sort of speaking to the financial climate, is I've always been opposed to having sale items because I don't know. I just think it kind of cheapens everything. But I did this year decide to do a sale bucket, and I had these Sock Monkey t-shirts that I put in the, because it was a color. It was, they're yellow, and I think they're fabulous, but they never really sold well. Mm-hmm. So I put them in a sale bucket, and people are like, "Well, I'll buy these then." And I sold probably like 20 of these t-shirts.
Oh wow!
For not that much less, because it's sort of like the idea that they're cheaper.
Right. The whole psychology of seeing the sale sign that people like, wow, yeah. I gotta grab special. This. Yeah.
And the other thing I'll do is like no cost special pricing. So that a price might be a little bit more like on my website I sell fitted sheets, mm-hmm. fitted crib sheets for $40, mm-hmm. and at no cost maybe they're $35.
Okay. So people know so that they gotta buy now and to yeah. save the money.
That's the other thing, is that people are like, oh, you can hand out so many business cards, and that's just like, it's just garbage, because very rarely is somebody going to contact you. I mean, it's true that they will, but for as many as you hand out, you may not get any contact. And people are like, oh, do you sell these online? No, I don't. Buy it.
Yeah, I have a lot to learn when it comes to like selling my own stuff, because I'm great at promoting other people's stuff and telling people like, hey, check out booth number 56 down there. Awesome buttons, you know. I've actually talked people out of buying my stuff.
Oh,
I know. It's like it's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. But you've given some great advice about that, so thank you for sharing that. And I want to talk a little bit, kind of your Sock Monkey t-shirt thing reminded me of you've done a lot of really cool like art. And I know you had your Sock Monkey dress that got quite a bit of press. When was that, when you came up with you created that dress?
Well, there's actually two dresses that I created. The first one I made in 2002. I didn't mention this earlier, and you can strike this if you want, but when I was working at Kmart, they had a tuition reimbursement program. So although I didn't go to Wayne State for fashion design and merchandising, I ended up taking a lot of classes in the fiber arts department, and I had an awesome instructor. His name is Urban Giappina, Urban Romeo Giappina, the best name ever.
Name. Wow.
I know. I love Urban. But and he was so supportive and so encouraging, and he still is today, that he really encouraged me to apply to get a master's in fiber arts at Wayne. So while I was there, I was in the master's program, which I never finished, and he still sort of haunts me to this day. But while I was there, I got really involved in weaving. Funny, you should mention weaving.
I love weaving. Yeah, I got involved in weaving the semester before I was to graduate from Central, and I almost stayed because I loved it so much. But
Yeah, it was great. I used to go in. I would take night classes, and I would go in, and I had this loom that was just my loom to use. And I would just stay for hours weaving and weaving. And I would make these, I don't know, bizarre woven things that I couldn't, I mean, he's more of like a traditional weaver, like wall hanging kind of guy.
Yeah.
And I, because of my apparel background, I'm like, okay, I'm going to weave this and make some clothing out of it. So in 2002, I made my first Sock Monkey thing. It was hand woven, and it was a dress, which I coined Monkey 1 and Monkey 2. And it's the dress where there's a monkey face on each breast and a big red ass. And I had no idea how to knit. I thought I would never knit. I thought I would never learn to knit. And so I sat there and played with different weft configurations to sort of simulate the tweedy texture look of the Sock Monkey sock, mm-hmm. and came up with something I liked. And I made this dress, and there's a backpack that goes on it. It was supposed to be like a baby carrier, and it carries a conjoined monkey, which is where it all began with my first conjoined monkey that I made in 2001. I don't know why. I don't know what got me so into the Sock Monkey. I never had a Sock Monkey. My mom had no idea what Sock Monkeys were. She's like, what is this thing you're making? I was really into eBay like 2000, 2001 and like just trolling eBay for things. And I came across these sock monkeys and I was so intrigued because people gave them these wacky, wacky personas. It was like the sock monkey came to life, like the little Bo Peep monkey. And she would have her story about her sheep and all this stuff. And I'm like, who are these crazies who are writing these stories about these monkeys that are so intriguing and ingenious? And I'm like, well, I'm going to make a sock monkey that's going to top all the other sock monkeys with a story beyond stories. So I made this conjoined sock monkey, so a two-headed, four-legged, two-armed monkey, and wrote this story, which I have someplace in a printout form, and my computer has long since crashed, so I don't have it online. But just the story of how the sock monkey came to be and that they were looking for a good home. And this was in 2001, and this conjoined sock monkey sold on eBay for around $65.
Wow.
Which was pretty incredible. And I got all kinds of, like, fan emails from people. That's the funniest thing I've ever read. Ha ha ha. And I felt really pleased with myself.
You probably could get more now.
Well, you know what I didn't know, and I still have a couple. A friend of mine had given me these, she would give me buttons periodically, and she gave me these eyeball buttons, which I use. And she's like, oh, after the fact, I'm so happy to see you use those Bakelite eyes on that monkey. I was like, oh, really? Oops. I didn't even put that in the description. Real Bakelite eyes. But anyway, so in 2002, I made this dress and it was sort of like the mother to this monkey. So that monkey or a monkey that was made to like the one that I sold on eBay was worn on the back. And I really didn't explore the sock monkey again until much later. While I was at Target, I didn't do much sewing. I didn't do much crafting. I did start knitting. I learned to knit two nights before I moved to Minneapolis from a friend of a friend because I think, oh, I need to find something to do to pass the time. I'm moving to a city where I know no one and I just have a job and no hobbies. You know, I'm just like living in this corporate housing for 2 months. So I started knitting and that was pretty much what I did until I left Target. And a friend of mine invited me to apply to participate in this fashion show, which was at the Walker Arts Center, put on with the Walker Teen Arts Council. And basically it was called an unprom and you're supposed to make a prom dress, but a not traditional prom dress. And I had this brilliant idea that I was going to make a maternity prom dress. And the more people I told, the more people told me that it was in really bad taste.
Because was this for kids? Like, was kids involved? Oh, yeah, with kids involved, it might not be a good thing.
So, and I don't know what it was, but I decided to make a sock monkey prom dress. And the event was in April 2006. So I started working on it in early 2006. So this is after I left Target, which was December 2005. So, I mean, I think that this really contributed to the success of my business in terms of like happy timing within 4 months of my corporate departure. So I made the sock monkey dress and I had always been intrigued by knitting machines and always wanted a knitting machine. And I don't know if you're familiar with knitting machines.
Yeah, I have one that's not electric, just one that cheap one that they sell. I don't even know what the brand is.
Mine's not electric either.
Well, mine, I took it out and I haven't taken it out since we moved, since I last worked with this thing. And I think I was trying to do something on deadline pressure with the machine and it just didn't go so well for me. So I'm going to try to take it out again and give it another shot. But
well, I'll tell
it
you
didn't
what
like might... me very much, I don't think.
Well, what might be the problem is that they can't sit for a long period of time. And if it's do you have the Bond knitting machine?
I don't know. It's the one, it's like plastic. They sell it at craft stores.
It's the ultimate sweater machine or something.
So yeah. Not to knock the, you know, cause I just,
yeah, no.
I would say I would blame it on operator error, not so much the product, you know?
I don't know if it's built the same, but there's a thing in there called the sponge bar or needle retention bar. And that's what helps the needles move in and out.
Oh.
And if your machine sits for an extended period of time with a sponge bar in it, you know how sponges deteriorate and rot?
Yeah.
The sponge might be rotten and you might need a new sponge. And if you get a new sponge, it might work great.
Okay. Good to know.
So anyway, Yeah, that's little sidebar technical advice.
Yeah, no, good to know. Yeah, because I mean, otherwise you just sit there looking really, I mean, getting upset because it's not working. Yeah.
So I had borrowed one from somebody years ago, couldn't figure it out, and a friend of mine from Target one year for my birthday, she shows up, she says, "I have a gift for you," because I'd talked about them, and she shows up and she handed me a standard gauge Brother machine with a Ribber.
Wow.
I mean this. And she used it in college and she hadn't touched it for years. And she gave me a bulky machine. And so I had these things. I didn't know what to do with them. And I really wanted to know what to do with them. And she helped me try to figure it out. And we couldn't figure it out. And it sat for a couple of years. And then I got involved in this thing at the Walker and decided, well, I want to knit this dress, but I want to machine knit it. But I don't know how to use this thing. I don't know how to use this device. So there's a place in Minneapolis called the Minnesota Textile Center, which is, it's a pretty unique organization. I think also, again, speaks to the arts here. And it's a textile arts organization. They house like the Knitting Guild and the Weaving Guild and the Quilting Guild. And they have classes and workshops and they've got a gallery space. And it's a pretty fantastic.
Wow, great.
It's a great organization. And I contacted them and said, "Hey, I've got this knitting machine. Do you have any contacts for me to figure out how to use this thing?" And they gave me the name of this woman, Jane Nemi. And I called her and said, "I got your name and number from, you know, the textile center, and I want to make the sock monkey dress. And they said that maybe you could help me." She says, yeah, I can help you. What's your schedule? Come over on this day and I'll show you how to use it." So I go over and, oh my gosh, can I just tell you right now, they hooked me up with the most amazing person and she's a great friend. and she's like my machine knitting buddy. But she couldn't comprehend what I was doing. She's thinking the whole time that I want to make a dress for a sock monkey doll.
Oh, which is dramatically different than what you're trying to make.
Right? Yeah, which is dramatically different from this giant dress that probably weighs 15 pounds or 20 pounds of yarn. And she got me started and I worked on this thing and I didn't really know what I was doing. This is the first thing I've ever machine knit in my life. And it's cut and sew. Like I knit the panels, but there was a lot of swearing and a lot of needle breakage and a lot of drama, but it got done and it debuted at this fashion show. And based on the crowd response at the fashion show, there would be an ensemble deemed they would be the king and queen of the prom, and the sock monkey dress was the queen of
oh,
the prom.
Wow, that's cool.
That's where it started, and you know, great fun night. Brought it home, put it in a box. Didn't think of it. In the meantime, I joined the Machine Knitting Guild of Minnesota, and Jane said to me, "You've got to bring this your dress to our next meeting." So I bring the dress to the next meeting, and these ladies go nuts. They're like, "Oh my God, that is crazy. That is, I mean, because it's a huge undertaking." And they said, "You must enter this dress in the Minnesota State Fair." And I'm thinking, what are you talking about? Because I've been to a state fair before. It was the Detroit State Fair.
Right.
And being on the west side of the state, I imagine you have better state fairs. Better fairs than the state.
Well, the Michigan State Fair that they have held in Detroit for several years, I think they've decided this year they can't afford to have it next year.
It is the saddest.
So that's how sad it is. I mean, that's just how truly sad it is. So,
well, yeah, that's my experience. And I hear people talk about the Minnesota State Fair here, and I've never been, but I was like, okay. So it turns out there's this creative activities competition, and there's all these different categories and lots that you can enter things into, and they're judged, and you can get ribbons, and there are prizes. Like, depending on the category, the first place prize might be $6. Then you get $4 for second place and $2 for third place. Fantastic prizes. But anyway, I entered. So they gave me the book of the different categories to enter, and I say, okay, well, I look through, and I'm going to enter this dress. And I entered that dress, and I'm like, well, I'll enter the woven dress too, since I can enter in the weaving category. And then I'll enter. So I entered as many things as I could find around the house that I had handcrafted that would fit into categories.
To try and get $6. Yeah.
Well, I think it's just the excitement of it.
Right? No, I would do the same thing, but I don't have a sock monkey dress waiting in my closet either.
I didn't know what I was getting involved in. So I dropped this stuff off at the fair, like, okay, whatever. I put some finishing touches on it because I never really finished, because I worked on this dress so hard, I never finished it for the fashion show. It was like one of those typical fashion show things where
right, it was like taped together, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was just ridiculous. So I finished it because they're going to judge every aspect of it. Like, they look at the details, I was told. So the fair hadn't opened yet, and I got a call from somebody in the office there saying, Care 11, which is the local news channel, saw the dress and they want to interview you. And I was like, what? And apparently somebody had posted pictures online in Tampa Bay News in Florida, picked up the dress and put it on their news feed. And before I knew it, it was all over the internet, like nobody's business. And it was absolutely insane. So this was in September of 2006, and I was getting all sorts of emails and calls, and I was just like, oh my God, we have to put some stuff online. Like, I got to get this dress online. I've got to do something. And it was like this huge event. And I think it's just like the sock monkey just appeals to so many people in both ways, love and horror.
Right.
Because
yeah.
People are horrified by this creature. I don't know what the horror is. So it just immediately got a ton of popularity. I mean, it was on, the Dress a Day blog, which is pretty big.
Yeah. That's a huge blog.
It was on Boing Boing.
Wow.
It was on FARC.
So it's everywhere.
It was really everywhere. And it was really funny because that September I went to Seattle for Bumper Shoot, which is a big, like, I don't know. I think it originally started as a music festival, but I used to play roller derby until this year. I played for 5 years, and they had a thing there called Bumper Bout. So there was a roller derby tournament, and there was this fantastic, Jenny Hart was there of Sublime Stitching doing a workshop, an embroidery workshop. And I told Trish, who owns Crafty Planet, she says, talk to her and try her to get her to come to Crafty Planet to do a workshop. So in the meantime, I'd had a couple wines and I was feeling pretty, pretty funny. And I thought I would test the boundaries also of this dress in terms of how far it had reached. And I asked her, like, I think that might've been in my opener, to ask her if she knew what it was. And she knew what it was.
Well, it was funny, 'cause when I met you, I saw the sock monkeys and I'm like, are you the one that made the dress? And you're like, yep, that's me. I mean, it was really, it's funny how broad that dress. I mean, everybody saw that dress.
Based on the excitement and the success of this dress, I then had the brilliant idea to make the sock monkey t-shirts.
And for those people who haven't seen those t-shirts, describe what the t-shirt looks like.
So basically I knit the individual faces. So there's a sock monkey face with eyes and ears. It's three-dimensional and the mouth is stuffed. And I applique them on the front of t-shirts. And primarily for kids. And yeah, I sell them on the website and they come in an assortment of colors. And like I said, they sell well when there's press. So I made them in time for the No Coast Craft Fair, December of 2006. And I didn't make enough of them. It was quite phenomenal. And I think the following year, then I was like, well, if I'm making these t-shirts with faces for kids, don't you think they need pants with tails?
Oh, that's so funny.
So now I have pants with tails as well.
Oh, how cute.
And back to circle back to my brilliant webmaster brother. I have the domain name sockmonkeys.com, which,
that's awesome.
Which, you know, you hear, I think there's a stereotypical thing of, like when you do, when, you know, some women, when they have a breakup, they cut their hair off, or sometimes when you have a breakup, there's retail therapy and you go shopping and you buy yourself something.
Right.
He had, being a computer dude, I won't say geek. He had gone through a breakup and his retail therapy was buying the domain name sockmonkeys.com.
Well, it seems like a pretty high tech way to cope, you know?
Yeah, well, I'm very fortunate. I didn't pay for it.
And you benefited from his breakup situation, recovery phase there.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and you know, we need to back up too, because we know that you started getting all this attention and press before the state fair even opens. What happened at the state fair when it opened? Did people just go crazy? Were people crying in front of the dress?
People went absolutely crazy. I went and I stood next to the case and wrote down commentary. Like, just things that would come out of people's mouths. I mean, my favorite, there were some really funny ones. This woman said about the original dress, the woven dress with the face on each breast. She said, "Look, it's got faces on the hee-haws." I was like, the hee-haws? Really? Okay.
That's what you call them at the state fair.
Yeah, because you don't say boobies.
Yeah. That's funny. But, and so did people know that you were the creator of the dresses?
No.
Or you're just trying to pass off as just being any other, you know?
Yeah, well, they had no idea anyway, because the whole thing is, it's, what do you say?
Like, anonymous or something?
Like it's anonymous. Like, the judges don't know who it is. So the stuff is in the case, but there aren't names on things. So nobody knows who made what. And I started looking on the internet, and you could Google sock monkey dress, and you can see all kinds of pictures on Flickr, because people are taking pictures at the state fair and putting them on their Flickr sites and sending them to friends. And I still meet people who tell me, "Oh my gosh, you made that dress? That picture's hanging in my cubicle at work." Like, they're still really excited about it.
Did you have anyone offer to try to buy one of the dresses?
I did. I sold one.
You did? Really?
I did. Uh-huh. It's a strange story. I sold it through my website to a woman in Portland, Maine. And I won't sell that dress because it was made specifically for an event. I think since then I've made improvements and I can make it better. Plus it's the sock monkey dress. I'm going to keep it.
Yeah.
But this woman contacted me through my website. She was really excited and she wanted me to make her this dress. But she wanted a shorter length one. She wanted it knee length because she's very petite. And she sent me her favorite fitting dress, which I used as a basis or foundation for the style. And I did a mock-up in muslin and sent it to her, and her friend's a tailor, and her friend made some alterations, sent it back to me, and I made her this dress. The dress is not cheap. You'll know that if you look at the website. I send her the dress. I never heard a peep.
Really?
Nothing.
After you send this dress.
That she spent a lot of money on. And that horrifies me. I'm just like, and then it made me afraid to contact her.
Yeah, that is kind of, because you kind of have a best, almost like a relationship started because you've gone back and forth, you know the woman's measurements. I mean, you know what I mean? It's kind of an intimate thing, you know?
Yeah.
And then to not hear anything is interesting. Was this for a wedding or something or for a, I mean.
No, it was just because.
Oh.
She's like, all I know is that, I mean, I know a few things about her, but I think at the time her son was a student at NYU, and I think she was on some board there, and she was excited to wear it to some events. She's like, "Oh, people love this," but I've searched for her online, and you think you'd find a picture of her in this dress,
right? Because it's a pretty. Someone's going to take a picture of that, yeah.
So then I'm like, did it not fit her? Did she not like it? Did something happen to her? Hmm. What? So, but yeah, I've sold the dress. Uh huh.
And I do want to get back to your book, the One Yarn Wonders book that you said has gotten some really great reviews out there. Now, you basically put the word out. How did you guys round up 101 sewing projects that are made with just one yard of fabric? Because that sounds like that had to be a pretty major undertaking to get all those patterns organized and whittled down to 101.
Just to start at the beginning, because how we got this project anyway was bizarre. If that's relevant,
yeah,
like how we got stuck with this. But Trish, who owns Crafty Planet, who I mentioned earlier, she had a lunch date set up with a publisher. This was in February of 2008. And she says, "Hey, I'm having lunch with these people from Story Publishing. Do you want to come with me?" Yeah, great. I had no idea what the premise of the lunch date was or what the discussion was going to be, but I'm like, lunch sounds great. I'll be there. So we go and we have lunch, and it was with three fantastic women from Story Publishing out of Massachusetts, one of which was a president. And I don't know, I just start, as you can see, I just start talking and talking and talking and tangenting and talking. And by the end of the lunch, it's the same publisher who put out the One Skein Wonders book series that have been really successful. And they invited us. I think that they were just really excited that we were very excited about sewing and crafting and everything else. They invited us to put together a book proposal for One Yard Wonders. So we left this lunch where I just thought I was going to eat lunch with this invitation to put together a book proposal.
That's awesome.
Which was incredible. Which we did, and neither of us had ever written a book before. We had talked about it, and if to do anything like this, it would only be with Trish for me, because we work well together, and I really respect her and really appreciate her. So we put together this proposal and reviewed the contract, and I think everything was finalized late summer of 2008. And it was like, okay, we originally thought that this book, because most sewing books are about 35, 40 projects. That's what we thought it would be. Come to find out, no, no, no. We want 101 projects. And I'm just going, you got to be kidding me. How are we going to get 101 projects? And not only that, I mean, maybe not so much how are we going to get 101 projects, but how are we going to fit sewing projects into a book that doesn't have three volumes?
Right.
Unlike knitting, where basically, you know, I love knitting and I love knitters, but you've got knitting and you've got purling, and there's a whole, you know, it's like a formula for writing out patterns where it's not sentences.
Right.
You know, okay, one P1. Whereas if you can think about all the different ways that you can tell someone to hem a skirt.
Right.
So basically what I found myself doing, and I'm definitely more into them now, but I've never really been that interested in blogs. I've attempted to have my own blog. I suck at blogging. I forget about it. I don't think I'm interesting in what I write, and I don't really read other people's, but I decided that, you know, we need to find some projects. How are we going to do this? So I decided I'm going to start reading blogs, and they're really interesting and really fascinating. And bloggers are great, great people with interesting projects and anecdotes to share. You being one, of course. And I found myself, you know, I was up multiple nights until 2 a.m, which is very late for me, emailing people saying, love your blog, love your projects, love your tutorials. This is a project working on. Would you consider submitting a project and or also writing about our call for submissions on your blog? And we put the word out on like Craftster and on Etsy and some other forums. But really, the big draw was through bloggers. And they were incredible people to help us with this. And within a month, you could Google One Yard Wonders, and it was all over the internet, or as people say, the blogosphere. We received very close to 200 submissions, and we received submissions from all over the world. I mean, we received submissions from Australia, France, England. I feel like we got something from South Africa. I mean, really everywhere. It was all over. And there was a huge buzz about this book before we even finished selecting 101 projects. And maybe it was our No Coast experience in terms of categorizing, but we really looked at the projects. Well, we had favorites, and then we looked at them categorically, like how are we going to structure this and how can we build chapters from all of these submissions? Which we did, and gave them cute names, I think.
Well, what I like too, what I think is cool about the book is that you actually have the pattern pieces included, which is so lovely, because there's a lot of sewing books out there where you have to go take it to the local copy shop and try to figure out how to make 10 copies you can't use and then to finally get one that you can blow up to the regular size. So that was nice that you conveniently did that. Now, do you have, how many projects did you have to sew yourself for this book?
I did not sew very, very many. It was interesting because what we did was when we did our call for submissions, we basically said, if you've got a project already done, send us a photo and your instructions. If you've got the concept of a project, send us your ideas. Okay. You know, in the beginning, we didn't even require that. It was like, you know, if we thought that it was going to fit, then we would ask them to go further with it. And then basically there were, once we did our final edit of projects, we went back through all the photos and we said, and we looked at all the fabrics and we said, okay, what do we think looks fabulous for the book? And if we loved their project in the fabric that they had originally submitted it, we emailed them and said, we love it as it is, just send it to us. And if we thought that we loved their project, but we had a different idea in mind in terms of a print and pattern choice to make sure that there was diversity within the book, we sent them a yard of fabric. And what was really helpful is that Trish owns a fabric store.
Right.
So we had the world at our fingertips, you know, to cut these 1 yard cuts. And for the most part, people, then we would mail them a yard of fabric and they would recreate the project in that fabric and send it back to us. So there were a few cases where somebody, you know, maybe couldn't complete it in the time frame, or it wasn't realistic in terms of where they were geographically in the world that we did it, or they were projects of our own, which we made.
The thing that's really cool about what you've been able to do is, you know, if people are limited in their budget, a lot of times people think, oh, I can't really make stuff. I don't have, you know, I can't go to the fabric store and load up on all kinds of cool fabric. You only need to buy 1 yard, you know, and it's really kind of pushing people to see what's possible with a relatively small amount of fabric.
The book is 1 yard wonders, and all the projects take, you know, at the most 1 yard of fabric. Some actually take less. But once you lay it out, you might not even need, maybe you decide you don't want to use 1 yard of fabric. Maybe you decide, you know, you've got 4 fat quarters because you want it to be more patchworky. I mean, this is like, that's like the foundation, but you can really use what you have. And as somebody who sews and stockpiles, I don't need to buy anything for this book. I mean, sure, I go to a fabric store and I'll buy something, but...
Right, you can just work from your stash.
Yeah, and I love, in the beginning, we talk about the sewing pantry, and that was something that Trish coined. And it's kind of like, you know, you think about your kitchen. What do you, you've got flour, you've got sugar, you've got these staples in your kitchen that you have. And we speak about, okay, just as you would have in your kitchen, what would you have in your sewing pantry? You know, there's standard staples you need to have, or that you want to have, or you should have, and things that you collect that you might actually have everything you need to complete the projects in this book.
Well, and that's the good news too, because especially like in this economy, and people are looking for things that they can buy a book and be able to make things right away without having to go to the store and buy more supplies. So you guys have definitely filled that need for people.
You know what need I have? It's crazy. I was thinking about this. I was like anticipating our phone conversation and thinking about 1 yard wonders and how great it is to be able to use up your fabric. And I'm thinking, you know, that's great that we're helping people use their fabric. You know what book I need? I have a real sickness. I need the One Bolt Wonder book. I'm not kidding you. I was, as I said yesterday, I was wading through my craft swamp. I buy fabric by the bolt. What's wrong with me?
Well, you also have a business where you can't make what you're making in a yard. I mean, you need to have bolts of fabric, you know.
But I've got bolts of fabric that are still wrapped in plastic that are long since discontinued because I was going to reupholster a couch.
Yeah, well, you know, maybe that could be one of your follow-ups to you can have One Bolt Wonders for those who own small businesses and have these bolts of fabric they've been coveting and storing in their attics. Yeah, because it's funny. Yeah. Most people probably don't buy it by the bolt, but at least you have a business. So it's not like you're just a hobby sewer and, you know, you have all these bolts of fabric. So you have a little bit of a cover story there for an explanation for why you would have this. Well, I think we'll give people a chance to win a copy of the book too. I'll do a little giveaway. So that'll be fun. So people will be very excited to get their hands on a copy of the book so they can kind of go through and pick out, you know, I mean, I don't, do you have any favorite projects? Anything that you were like, wow, that's cool. Maybe things you've made yourself from here. I know it's hard to pick because they're all like your children, all these projects.
Well, one that I love that's a project of my own that I think is, I might be the most commonly hated project is the Spats pattern.
What piece is that one on?
Oh, you know, gosh, I had the book in front of me. It's in the women's clothing chapter towards the end.
And why is it hated?
Because it's ridiculous. But I love.
Yeah, now explain what these. They're kind of like leg warmers.
Yeah, they're like leg warmers, but they're kind of like, you know, they got the elastic that goes under your shoe, and I love the phrase, turn any shoe into a boot. However, the reason I say that they're most hated is because I was on the Powell Books website, and they have, like, staff reviews, and the staff review was hilarious. Like, with the exception of the children's clothing chapter and the spats, I'll probably make everything in this book.
Oh, my goodness. That's hilarious.
It's just such a specific project. But I did read on a blog recently that with the whole steampunk movement, that spats are on the rise, and there's a lot of knitted spat patterns out there. So maybe somebody will love these quilted spats, especially in the winter climate. But I'm a big fan of spats in general. The other project that I absolutely love is the slipcover for the folding card table chair. Just because, like, folding card tables,
they traditionally are pretty ugly. Yeah,
they're really bad, but they're also really simple and not that expensive. I mean, and there's the traditional ugly ones, and there's newer, cuter ones that are in colors at IKEA. But I love the idea that you can very quickly and economically create a new look if you're going to have a party, or if you can do something, you know, if there's some way to do a theme party, or maybe everybody has their own slip cover that's appropriate for them. But I just think it's a really easy, fun way to create a look mm-hmm. in your home, like, well, temporary.
And a lot of people too. I mean, if, you know, people are kind of trying to put a studio together and they don't have money for an expensive chair right away. Some people actually sit in folding chairs. You know, they incorporate them into their workspace or whatever. And to have it be kind of make it look a little prettier is a good thing. So I think this will serve a purpose. Yeah, because I never really thought too much about a slipcover for folding chairs. And now I am, you know, because I think I have some ugly ones around here. would look nice, because I mean, my fabrics, I mean, a lot of these I think a lot of us who buy fabric, we buy fabric and we sometimes hesitate to cut it because we're like, oh, it's so pretty in that one, you know, fold it up real nice, you know. But this, one of the things this book does is kind of encourage you to make the cut, you know, cut it up and actually incorporate it into your living space, whether that be a laptop, you know, cover, or, you know, just something to use for organization around your house. So I there's a lot of good ideas in here, and I think people will be able to get inspiration for just ways they can use their stash and actually take it out of the cupboards or the closet that it's in and make it part of their life.
I love the second project in the book, which is so simple, and it's a no-sew project, and it's lining a bookcase, mm-hmm. and maybe we'll get flack for that one, because it's like, oh, really? You're going to tell me how to line a bookcase? But can I tell you? For a fabric that you love that you don't want to cut into, it's brilliant. And I mean, yeah, I've probably seen it, but I've never really thought about doing that. It's something that just sparks your ideas and says, and you know, how can I use this differently? Or how can I really display this coveted yard of fabric? And change your look, change it next month, tape that one off and put a new one back there.
Right. Cause you're not gluing that down, are you? No, you're using tape. Yeah, I love that. Oh, and some spray adhesive. But I love the fact that you could actually pull it off and repurpose it in some other way. But it's, I think there's a lot of inspiration in here. And sometimes people just, you know, it's good to just kind of page through. And some of the ideas people might have thought, oh, okay, I could have thought of that on my own. But the thing is, to have a collection of them all right here, and chances are, if you saw it on somebody's blog where they lined a bookcase, chances are you probably forgot about it, you know, but now you have a new bookcase from Goodwill and you want to do something.
Right.
Two and two together and you're on your way. And so I think that's fun. And so are you guys working on a follow-up already to this?
Yeah, we are. We're getting ready. We're getting ready to work on a follow-up. We submitted our proposal and we're working with Story on that. And it's going to be, again, in the same vein of One Yard Wonders. In the sense that it's one yard projects, because I think it's so great, and it really, you know, it's they're easy to accomplish. But our spin which we'll be doing a call for submission soon, so I don't think it's too soon to mention it. For somebody who, you know, you love to sew and you stockpile fabric, just like knitters stockpile their yarn. But as a sewer, I have a lot more than printed cottons in my stash. I've got an ample supply of corduroys and denims and knits and wools and, you know, maybe some fancy satins or maybe some fleece or some other things. So what do you do with those other, what do you do with that stuff? We're going to break it apart by fabrication to give some tips and tricks for how to work with those other fibers. There are so many books out there now that are so good that are all, you know, I think that the quilting cotton book market is pretty saturated. I mean, everything is great prints and there's so many fabrics out there, but there's other fabrics that are just waiting. Use me, make something fabulous with me. And maybe you don't, because maybe you're not sure, you know, maybe you're intimidated by working with something other than a cotton. You know, maybe you're worried that, you know, the satin is too slippery, and what are the techniques you need to use? You know, what's the needle size, what's the stitch length, etc. So although the book will be structured by fabrication, we're certainly not saying, you know, you can only make this project in this fabric. It's again, it's ideas.
Right. To kind of get people started. And if they're interested in submitting something, a project to you, is there a place that I can refer them?
One great place to stay on top of what's happening is we've got a One Yard Wonders Facebook page.
Okay.
Which has been a great tool and a great way to keep in touch with people. Otherwise, our website is oneyardwondersbook.com.
Okay. And for the people that submit, I mean, when you have 101 people involved or thereabouts, can you pay the people, or what do people get? They get their 15 minutes of fame, and what do they get in exchange for being in the book?
Well, you did get a check. It's not a big check, but it's sort of a thank you check. You also get a free copy of the book.
So people get that recognition of being in a book. They'll get, there's some kind of honorarium, it sounds like, and a free copy. And you plan to do the same with your next book?
Yeah. And the other thing is that you can, we put it out there to all the contributors. If as a contributor, if you've got an idea in your hometown, a store, or some other way that you want to promote the book, our publicist at Story is happy to work with you to help you put that together. To make an event to promote your contribution and the book itself, as well as you'll have the opportunity as a contributor, you can buy books at the author discount of 50%, which I think is nice.
That's really nice.
But sorry. And then the other thing is that by submitting and contributing a project in this book, you're basically saying that Story Publisher has the rights to use your project for a one-time publication in this book. You still retain all the rights to your project. You're not giving anything up. You can continue to sell a PDF. You can publish it on your blog if you want. You can sell the completed project. It's still your project. You own it.
I know we've covered a lot of ground, but I know one of the questions I often ask people that I didn't get around to asking you yet, what would you say is the biggest challenge that you've had to overcome in your life to get, you're in a place now where, I mean, your name is out there. You have a successful business. You have a successful book. You're famous sock monkey making woman, you know. what has been the hardest part, though, for you as you made this journey to the successful place you're in right now?
I think time. I think that there's not enough hours in the day. I think if I were to do this all over again, if I were to start fresh, I would do it a little differently. I currently have my studio space in my home, which has been great because it's really convenient. I don't necessarily need to get dressed. However, I can't turn it off.
Right.
There's so many great artist studios here in Northeast Minneapolis where I live that if to do it again, I would rent a studio space so that I could go to work and, you know, I'd have my designated time frame during the day, and I can turn it off and I can walk away from it, because as it is now, I'll be working late in the night, which is sometimes handy, but also I feel guilty that I'm like, oh, it's up there. I need to get up there and work on it. Mm-hmm. And so I think time has really been a challenge, and not having enough time in the day to do other things because my work maybe takes away from free time or you know, free-flowing creative pursuits that aren't necessarily, you know, paid pursuits.
Right.
Which isn't a bad challenge to have, right?
Right. No, it's not so bad. Well, I think that you've given us a lot to kind of, you know, think about, and you've given now a whole book to inspire people, and we'll give people a chance to win a copy on the blog. And I don't know if there's anything I didn't ask you that you want people to know about you.
I would like more people to get involved in machine knitting. That's something I would like. That's my call. That's my call to all of you crafters. It's a fabulous craft. And don't think that because it's called machine knitting that I plug anything into a wall. It's 100% manual and hand manipulated. It's an interesting craft, and one which I think is hopefully going to come back, but also dying. A lot of machine knitters are quite a bit older, and I'd like to see some young faces participating alongside me.
Yeah. Well, that might be, maybe that's the next thing to make a comeback, because, everything else seems to be cycling back around.
Well, it's a tricky thing because there were a lot of like knitting machine people who made them. And I know that brother who the machine that I use, like their factory burnt down in the 80s or something like that. And it was so not lucrative, they decided not to rebuild. So they don't actually make anything anymore.
That would be the challenge now for people coming to the craft if they can't find a machine.
Yeah, but I will also say that Lion Brand Yarn, I just went to their store in New York a couple weeks ago, which was great. They are, through their catalog, they're selling a knitting machine, which I was so excited to see. And they also have a yarn that they're selling on cones, which is machine friendly. I think machine knitting has a reputation for being cheap because a lot of acrylic yarn is used, but don't think you have to use acrylic. I use really nice yarns when I machine knit. You can use your Malabrigo. You can use any yarn you want. It doesn't have to be on a cone. Just wind it into balls. But I do this big call for machine knitters. Join me.
Well, we'll see what we can do to help you get the word out.
Get yours up to your bed.
Yeah, I'm going to have to. Mine's in the basement, but it's probably got to rot it out. I'm going to have to change that sponge piece. But thanks for that tip, because I never would have thought to do that.
So, my pleasure.
Yeah. Rebecca, I really appreciate your time, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you.
See, I told you that interview was going to go places. Thank you so much to Rebecca for spending time with me. If you hear some opportunities in your community to enter a kind of off-the-wall fashion show, or, you know, enter an art show and do something and use the crafty talent that you have, whether that be knitting or sewing or operating a knitting machine, why not push the limits and see if you can apply those skills in a not so practical, but very artistic way. You know, certainly Rebecca doesn't walk around wearing her sock monkey dresses, but boy, did that put her on the map. We'll have a photo and we'll have some links to the sock monkey dresses, but you know, once you see it, you don't forget it. And so it's Rebecca is really inspiring in the sense that she's taken kind of blazed her own trail and has really made a name for herself, and that's wonderful to see. So congratulations, Rebecca. We wish you all the best. If you would like to enter the drawing to win a free copy of One Yard Wonders, all you have to do is head over to craftsanity.com and leave a comment. Just tell us what you like to make, your favorite project that takes 1 yard or less of fabric. And you're like, whoa, that's been done before. It's in Rebecca's book. True. But actually, you know what? Let's change this a little bit. Your favorite project in a quarter yard or less. Okay? So it has to be something that can be made out of a quarter yard or less of fabric. That changes things a tad there. So I love miniature projects, and I love the fact that with these giveaways, it's so inspiring to see what people are making and read the comments. I really enjoy that. So head over to craftsanity.com, leave a comment, and you will be entered to win a copy of the book. Good luck, everyone. I want to take a moment to thank the episode sponsor, Liberty Worth, over at Libby Dibby. She is the force behind this really cool line of handmade skirts, stamped charms, baby slings, bigs, and more that you can find over at libertyworth.com, or you can check out the Etsy shop, libertyworth.etsy.com. You can read the Libby Dibby blog at libbydibbystuff.blogspot.com. I took a look at the Etsy shop, and it seems like I've been there before. It was kind of like a deja vu effect, but such cute stuff, the skirts especially. I'm like absolutely drooling over these wraparound skirts. I love them because they're adjustable and look so comfortable, and they're kind of long, you know, those skirts where you can actually bend down and pick something up and not worry that you're going to be arrested for indecent exposure. Not that I normally dress that way, but I just think of all these things because wardrobe malfunctions, I've had a few in my life. And so when I look at a garment, that's one of my criteria for assessing, will my dignity be intact if I sashay around in this outfit? But anyway, check out libertyworth.com and the Etsy shop and the blog, and I think you'll be inspired and impressed by what you find. Supporting Libby Dibby, buying Libby Dibby stuff, is a way of supporting craftsanity.com and keeping this podcast going. So I really appreciate the sponsorships, and I really appreciate those of you who keep the sponsors in business, because they help keep me going with this podcast. So we all help each other, and it works out really nice. If you'd like to be a sponsor of an upcoming episode of Craft Sanity, click on the sponsors link and you can read some details there. And then if you're interested, send us a message, sponsors@craftsanity.com, and we'll get back to you. I'm going to get on to the after show, and I'll be back soon with another episode. In the meantime, Craft Sanity, my friends, it works for me. Hey, thanks for sticking around for the after show. Yeah, I just wanted to thank all of you listeners for 4 wonderful years here at Craft Sanity. The podcast and blog officially turned 4 on January 23rd, and that was pretty cool. I just feel really appreciative and thankful to even have an opportunity to be able to produce this show and talk to all the creative folks I've been able to talk to, and then get connected to all of you listeners and blog readers. So thank you so much for 4 really fun years. I really appreciate it. And I am looking forward to what might happen in the next 4. I think it's going to get even more exciting because I am completely addicted to the podcast and plan to keep doing this as long as I can. So thank you so much for your support. Yeah, and as far as the running goes, I'm going to be running a 25K on May 8th. I'm doing the 5th Third Riverbank Run. It's the biggest 25K in the country. And I'm very lucky because it's right here in Grand Rapids, Michigan. So I can wake up in my own bed and head down to the starting line. And that's going to be nice because I don't really sleep that well when I'm in a hotel. So I think that'll be really fun to finally get to the race day. There's going to be a lot of work between then and now. Did hill work tonight. And let me just tell you, that was tiring. I know hill work pays off, though. It was when I've done it in the past. Did it before I ran a marathon, and it really does help, because when you're in a race and you see a hill in front of you, you think, no problem, I'm only going to do this once. When you do hill workouts, you repeat the hill multiple times. Tonight, I ran the same hill up and down it 10 times, and I will probably feel that tomorrow. Yeah, it'll probably be pretty serious soreness going on tomorrow, but no pain, no gain. Since I am partnered with a charity for this 5th Third Riverbank Run, I'm working with Safe Haven. It's a women's shelter here in town. And I'm going to be doing kind of we're in the planning stages, but we're going to be doing kind of a little art and craft show kind of connected to this. So I hope to be putting out a call for quirky and cool aprons soon. And it's going to be kind of a little contest, kind of like an art show for people who make aprons, and also we're going to be doing some work with men's ties. So I'll update you guys as soon as I have details. And I've been wanting to tell you guys about this for so long, and I just don't have all the details. So as soon as I have those, I'll let you know what's going on. The other excitement around here is I'm going to be making some looms, hopefully this weekend, in specialty woods, which most of the Craft Sanity weaving looms are made out of oak. It's a very nice, solid, sturdy wood. But we're going to get a little more exotic here. And we're going to be offering some walnut, cherry, and probably some maple as well. And the walnut is very pretty. So I'm really anxious to kind of get working with some of these other species of wood. I think it's going to be really cool. So keep an eye out for those.
And I'm still in kind of clutter central. My studio and office are like complete disasters. I have made some very small progress, but I really need to purge more stuff out of here and really get organized. You know how it is. I just have this tendency to fill my day to capacity. So every second of my time is taken with something, and there's just no time. I feel like, okay, if I take a day to straighten everything up, I'm going to lose time, when actually that's ridiculous. I'd actually save time if I knew where everything was. So if any of you are struggling with this, you're not alone. I have this pretty serious clutter issue going on right now, and it is, I would say, just about crippling, because I spend a lot of time searching around for things, and I'm so tired of that. So, yeah, I think I'm about a step away from bringing in some professional help. I mean, seriously, I think I might need an organizer to come in and kind of coach me through this process. And as usual, if you have anything you want me to know, any story ideas, show ideas, anything that you're making that's cool that you think would be fun for me to share in a TV segment, I do these weekly little TV segments every Friday on a local morning show, and I just demonstrate some kind of little craft project. I'm going to be doing some Valentine's Day stuff on Friday. I still have to iron out exactly what I'm going to be doing. A lot of times I'm flying by the seat of my pants, and I always credit, like if I get an idea from somebody else, I will not try to claim it as my own. I like to credit people who have great ideas, and sometimes I'll spot something on the web and contact the person, the blogger or the person that's making something cool, and say, hey, you know, can I show your idea on TV? And, you know, that's fun. I feature a lot of local people, but I am definitely not opposed to shining the light on someone far away. And with the internet, I always have information about how to make the thing, whatever the craft project is. I always have directions on my website. So I post that when I return home from the station, I post it on my website. And so people can check out the blog or the website of the person that submitted the idea. So keep that in mind. Yeah, as far as, it's not really a New Year's resolution, it's just something that I wanted to do this year. I really want to start making some of my own clothes and clothes for my daughters. I haven't really taken any steps to do that yet, and really itching to do that. So I'm hoping to very soon. I've been collecting patterns, and there's been some delightful new books that have come out that have been so inspiring. So I'm kind of chomping at the bit to get working on some things. I'm very excited. Tomorrow night I'm going to meet with, well, actually, this will probably be posted on Wednesday, the 27th. So Wednesday night I'm going to be at the Y in Grand Rapids, and I will be there for a craft club. It'll be our first meeting of 2010. We're going to meet on a monthly basis this year. It was weekly, and then I dropped it down to bi-weekly, and now we're going to be monthly. Just a lot of us have a lot of stuff going on, and you know, it just seems like this is going to work for the meantime. So for the next phase, that's where I'll be. If you're local, if you're in West Michigan, by all means, come on down to Craft Club, 6:30 at the David D. Hunting YMCA in Grand Rapids, and just ask the people at the front desk, tell them you're looking for Craft Club, and they'll tell you where you need to go. And it's open to everybody. You don't have to be a member. So just bring a project and come pull up a chair to the craft table. We have a lot of fun, and it's just great to connect with other creative people who want to just take a break and sit there and work on their projects. So it's been really fun. And yeah, I think I'm going to let you go. I think this is a long enough after show, and I think I'm feeling a little tired because I just ran a little while ago, and it seems like it's really funny. I'll have a lot of energy. Like I feel kind of this like, you know, woohoo, you know, you're all jazzed up and then you crash pretty quickly after that. So that's the one thing that's been really hard with the running is it's kind of forcing me to sleep. And my MO is to basically work until I drop, and, you know, now I don't get enough sleep. So maybe this the increased mileage will actually help me develop better and healthier sleep patterns. So one could hope. I know my mother's been hoping that I would sleep more my whole life because I'm not a very good napper or sleeper. So anyway, well, you folks have a great week. I'm going to be back soon with another episode. I'm going to aim to be back next week with another interview for you to listen to. And I've got some cool people lined up that I want to interview soon. So we're going to have a good lineup here in 2010. If you have any recommendations for me, feel free to send those my way. Jennifer@craftsanity.com. With all that said, I'm going to let you guys get on with your day. Do something fun and crafty today. You'll feel better if you do. And I'll get busy on the next show.